And I will be firm in accepting questions that are thematic and that are pertinent to the presentation. For any other demonstrations, I would appreciate that we wait until the session is over. Without further ado, we'll pass it on to Papa Salif Sow. The format of the session will be such that we will have 10 minutes for the presentations and 5 minutes for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Julio. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's my pleasure now to introduce the first speaker, David Simpson from the United States, who will present us this communication on a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multicenter trial on pregabalin versus placebo in the treatment of neuropathic pain associated with HIV neuropathy. David, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the chairs and the conference organizers for having the opportunity to lead this exciting session. I'm going to discuss some very new data concerning management of painful peripheral neuropathy in HIV. As background, over a third of patients with HIV and AIDS have neuropathy. In fact, recent data we have from an NIH study in the U.S. is over 50%. Neuropathy is frequently misdiagnosed and undertreated. Of course, some of the medications used in HIV can cause neuropathy, such as the D drug antivirals. Pain is a major debilitating symptom. It affects quality of life, adherence to medication, and in several groups within the NIH, within neurology of HIV, neuropathy has been designated the single highest priority. And we focused on pregabalin because it's been demonstrated effective in several other forms of neuropathy like diabetes and postherpetic neuralgia. The primary objective of this particular study, 1066, was to evaluate the efficacy of pregabalin compared to placebo in reducing neuropathic pain associated with HIV neuropathy. There were a number of secondary aims, which I'll come to through the course of the presentation. These were male and female patients with HIV over 18 years old. 40 sites in the U.S. and Puerto Rico participated. And the neuropathic pain needed to be present at least 3 months and confirmed by a neurologist on examination. Now, this slide is a bit complex, but it summarizes the design of the study. There was an initial screening period. Patients were then randomized to pregabalin, which is an anticonvulsant, the next generation of gabapentin, which is a calcium channel agent working on the alpha-2-delta ligand of the calcium channel. And once patients were randomized, they either had placebo, and they began at 150 milligrams per day. Every 4 days, they could then increase the dosage to 300 milligrams and 600 milligrams based on tolerability. So this was a flexible dosing schedule where patients could increase dose based on how they tolerated the drug. They then had a 12-week maintenance phase of pregabalin versus placebo and then a washout period. Here are the demographics of the cohort, placebo versus pregabalin, approximately 150 patients in each group. About 80% of them were men, which although we would have liked to have more women, this is better than most neuropathy studies have done in accruing women. In our cohort, about 56 to 58% white, 30 to 38% black. And the history of D drug antiviral use, D4T and the others, 9 to 13%. Remember, this was a US-based cohort where D-drug use is far less than it used to be, certainly not the same in other populations in other parts of the world. The mean pain score on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being no pain, 10 being worst possible pain, was about 6.7 to 6.9, moderate to severe pain. As far as patients that discontinued the study, about 20% in both groups. Interestingly, most study discontinuations were unrelated to study drug. About 5% in the pregabalin group discontinued due to a drug-related adverse event. The dosing. Remember, patients could dose from 150 milligrams to 600 milligrams per day, and the average daily dose in the pregabalin group turned out to be 386 milligrams. And here you see the breakdown of the three dose groups in the pregabalin group. About 53% were able to get to the maximum dosage of 600 milligrams. So here's the first primary result. Remember that it was a 14-week trial, and this is pain reduction from 0 to 10. Patients began with a median of 6.7 in pain, and here we have the absolute reduction. Pregabalin in blue, placebo in yellow. Notice that at week 1 and week 2, there was a significant difference in pain reduction favoring pregabalin, although the placebo response then almost met the pregabalin response, and there was no further significant difference from week 4 and beyond. Here's another way of demonstrating the data result. This is the so-called 50% response rate. This is the percentage of patients that had at least a 50% reduction in their pain from baseline. And although the absolute reduction was good, about 40% of patients had a greater than 50% pain reduction, no difference between pregabalin and placebo. Another of the secondary outcome measures was the patient global impression of change. How did patients feel about how they did in the study? From worse, no change, to improved. And notice here that there now was a difference favoring the pregabalin group in this global patient measure. As far as adverse effects, if we compare pregabalin to placebo, we see the similar types of effects observed in other studies of pregabalin in neuropathy: somnolence, dizziness, euphoria, and peripheral edema being most common. And so the conclusions of this first pass at the data is that there was no difference in endpoint mean pain score between pregabalin and placebo. Although up to week 2, pregabalin was favored, it did not extend beyond week 2, and responder rates also did not differ. I did not show you sleep interference score, which is the amount that pain interfered with patients' sleep, and this favored pregabalin up to week 6, but not beyond week 6. And we've talked about the global measure result. As far as safety, the safety results were very similar to those seen in studies of diabetic and post-herpetic neuralgia, with a relatively low rate of discontinuation. Now, to conclude, to put these data into a bit of context, I've already mentioned that pregabalin has been demonstrated effective in other forms of neuropathy, particularly diabetic and post-herpetic neuralgia. And why do we see a different result here with lack of efficacy as compared to those other responses? Well, here's a bit of a representative meta-analysis. This is our current study that I presented today in HIV neuropathy. Here we see 5 pooled studies of pregabalin in post-herpetic neuralgia, and now we see 7 pooled studies of pregabalin in painful diabetic neuropathy. And here we have placebo and several doses of pregabalin. Notice that in the successful studies in PHN and diabetes, the placebo response was far lower than we saw in the current trial, whereas the active pregabalin response, in fact, was quite comparable across these studies. So it was the higher placebo response in this study that washed out the effectiveness. Now, I can't possibly do justice to putting this study in context of all other studies done in symptomatic, painful HIV neuropathy. this single slide boils down a lot of trials to the single primary outcome. All placebo-controlled studies in HIV neuropathy. Notice many things did not work. Amitriptyline, which is a tricyclic antidepressant. Acupuncture versus sham acupuncture. Mixilitine, a type of lidocaine. Lidocaine gel. Notice that several of the anticonvulsants, lamotrigine and gabapentin, did show some improvement, although these were very small and difficult to replicate results. We did have some very exciting data with the high concentration capsaicin patch that we published in Neurology just a couple of months ago. Unfortunately, the first phase 3 positive result was not replicated in a second similar design. And one intriguing study from San Francisco showing smoked cannabis showed pain improvement. We now have several studies that are on the horizon that are soon to open, combinations of duloxetine, a type of antidepressant, with methadone, and a cannabinoid and methadone. There are numerous articles discussing why neuropathic pain is difficult to treat, and this couple of papers indicates, for instance, it is unclear whether these trials were unsuccessful because the medications truly lack efficacy or whether the characteristics of the trials compromise the demonstration of treatment benefit. And finally, in my last slide, although this is virtually impossible to read, this acknowledges the 40 sites that were participants and the support provided by Pfizer in conducting the trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Now this paper is open for question. We have time for 3 questions. Yes, go ahead.
Kubota from the United States. Was there any duration of diagnosis? Did that make a difference in the response rates?
The duration issue, in the demographic slide, I went through this very quickly, but the duration of neuropathy was on the order of approximately 6 or 7 years. But as far as the sub-analysis of whether duration of neuropathy had any impact on response, we have not yet done that type of analysis. These are very recent data, and those types of secondary sub-analyses, in a sense post hoc, will follow in the future.
Yes, next question. So, David, I have a question. At which clinical stage was this HIV patient when they were put on this new drug?
At which clinical stage?
Yes.
In terms of HIV and their disease state?
Absolutely, yes.
I don't know that I can answer that question specifically. I'm not sure if it's possible to pull up the demographic slide again, but we do have the CD4 counts for these patients, which would perhaps answer that question. By memory, I believe that they range somewhere in the 300 or so range, but I would have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
One point that can be made, let me see if we can pull that up. Well, here's the duration. No, I'm sorry, we don't have the CD4 information up here. But one of the points that I would comment on is that when we look at our database of neuropathy in at least U.S.-based studies today, it turns out that these are not all advanced patients. The pre-heart type of patient with very low CD4 being the most likely to have neuropathy is no longer the case. We now see quite a bit of neuropathy in patients who have relatively good CD4 counts, whether immune reconstituted or otherwise.
Thank you. Last question.
Any thoughts on why your placebo patients responded so well compared to previous placebo trials?
Well, that's the big question. Why such a high placebo response? The short answer is I don't know. There does appear to be, in the HIV field particularly, this very unpredictable placebo response in neuropathy trials. And as an example, in the high concentration capsaicin studies that I referred to earlier, the active response in the first and the second trial was almost exactly the same, but the placebo response in the two trials was quite different, leading to a first successful response and the second showing no difference from placebo. But why that is remains purely speculation.
Thank you very much, David, for this paper. Now we are moving on the next one, the 302, which will be presented by Joseph Babi Gumira from United States, on the cost effectiveness of programmatic models for provision of antiretroviral therapy in resource-limited settings. Joseph, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I'm very privileged to present this study on behalf of my co-authors, Dr. Sethi from the University of Madison in Wisconsin, and Drs. Smith and Singer from Case in Cleveland, Ohio. This was a cost-effectiveness study of programmatic models for the provision of ART in resource-limited settings. The current scale-up and future sustainability of ART programs in poor countries is limited, as we all know, by severe resource scarcity. And the scarcity implies that we have to make very tough choices with regard to the allocation of resources, especially personnel and drugs and infrastructure. And currently, ART programs are rolled out in a variety of ways, and there's been little attempts at formal efficiency evaluations. So this study was an attempt to contribute to the efficiency frontier in the policy discussion, which we feel is an important aspect of the policy agenda. The objective of the study was to compare the cost effectiveness of different programmatic models for provision of ART in resource-limited settings, and we used the example of rural Uganda. So what did we compare? We compared facility-based care, where patients are responsible for transporting themselves to clinic sites, with mobile clinic care, where patients sort of have the distance from their homes cut short by having mobile clinics taken a little bit closer to their homes, and with the well-studied home-based care, where all care takes place in patients' homes. And we're working under the hypothesis that access is the best in facility-based care. It improves with mobile clinic care and is highest for home-based care. And this was also a similar hypothesis for adherence to antiretroviral therapy. So we did a decision analytic Markov model, and we followed a hypothetical cohort of rural 35-year-old Ugandans, and they were all in stage 3 and 4 of disease. The model was based on clinical stage. We did a perspective of the Ministry of Health, and the costs exclude non-provider costs. The data came from primary surveys as well as the published literature. The time horizon was 10 years, and the main outcomes were cost, life expectancy, incremental cost effectiveness as measured by cost per quality adjusted life year. And the costs and outcomes were discounted at 3%, and we used a willingness to pay or cost effectiveness threshold of between 1 and 3 times the gross domestic product. Of course, in Africa it would vary, but for Uganda it would be between $350 and $1050. And we did a probabilistic sensitivity analysis using Monte Carlo simulation. So this was the decision tree. As you can see, patients enter the model when they are eligible for HART, and they go to one of three programmatic models. If they access HART, and then they go to the upper branch. If they don't, then they go to the lower branch. And then we have a branch for adherence or non-adherence. And then this transitions into a Markov model. And our Markov model had 7 states, and the cycle time was 6 months. And for each cycle, patients allowed to transition as follows: to move between stage 3 and 4, to remain adherent, to become non-adherent, or to die. And to remain non-adherent as well. And these are the data that we used to populate the model, These are the six-month transition probabilities taken from the literature. As you can see, in stage 3 and 4, the rates of transition, as well as the mortality. I won't go through them one by one, because of time. And then we had, these are the access assumptions and data. The access to ARV in Uganda in general is 33%, and adherence for home-based care was the highest, with 85% adherence. And then we performed a primary health-related quality of life survey. The instrument was EQ5D, and these are the results of that survey. These are utilities. And for non-ART patients, it's 0.69, and for ART patients, it's 0.84 in stage 3. And in stage 4, the utilities are lower for non-ART patients, as well as for ART, but they presented quite good quality of life. And these were the costs. For the first year of home-based care, it costs $1,000 per patient per year. And then those were the overhead costs for the different programmatic models. For home-based care, $600. Facility-based care, 229, and mobile clinics, 502. 237.5 was the cost of ART drugs, and the cost of illness in both stages refers to all non-drug costs of managing patients. And all costs are in 2008 US dollars, that done using South Africa's Consumer Price Index. So this is really the results of the analysis. As you can see, the expected survival at 10 years for facility-based care would be 9%, for mobile clinics would be 13%, and for home-based care would be 21%. I also call your attention to the costs, for home-based care being $6,000, for facility-based care being almost half that. And then I'll also draw attention to the figures in red, the incremental cost-effectiveness ratios. And these differ from the data in the abstract, primarily because cost assumptions have since improved. The ISA in cost per life years was 2015 for mobile clinic care and 2432 for home-based care. And in terms of quality adjusted life years, it was $2,451 per quality adjusted life year and $2,893 per quality adjusted life year for home-based care. And I also put there the threshold, just so you know what kind of willingness to pay we used as a threshold assumption. One-way sensitivity analysis indicated that this model was sensitive to the overhead cost of facility-based care as well as home-based care. And the mobile clinic model always got eliminated by extended dominance, that meaning that different combinations of home-based care and facility-based care make mobile clinic care not cost-effective. The model was also sensitive to high levels of access to facility-based care and home-based care, and low levels of adherence and access to mobile clinics. And again, mobile clinics were eliminated by extended dominance. For all other variables, the model was quite robust. And this is the results of our probabilistic sensitivity analysis. As you can see, this is a point where all models have the same percentage cost effective, and you'll see that the willingness to pay is right down here, very low, about $300 US, and if you take the upper part of 3x GDP, it goes to right there, and it shows that for facility-based care, it's highly cost effective with a high percentage, and home-based care becomes cost effective at high values of willingness to pay. So our study had some limitations, and we had not the best quality of access and adherence data. And also, we don't really know in the data, in the literature, what happens when patients stay on HART for a long time. We know that in Africa, adherence is really good, but we don't know what will happen in the next 15 years when patients have been on drugs for a long time. And we also didn't have a resistance parameter in this model, and we feel this is an important limitation to point out. So in conclusion, facility-based care was the most cost-effective programmatic model for ART provision. And this analysis supports that this should be the way to scale up and sustain ART programs in the long term, especially given that our levels of constraint maximization are really, really, really severe, because we have very low budget constraints, with most countries having $3 or $4 per capita health expenditure. And other care models really would need to demonstrate superior levels of access and adherence or largely reduced costs to become competitive. And we also say that home-based care would be really cost-effective if the willingness to pay was high. So if the threshold was $5,000, then that would be a different story. But in the face of such severe budget constraints, like I said, most countries spend very, very limited amounts of money per capita on health. We feel that such a scenario would be very, very remote. I'd like to acknowledge funding from the NIH and the Fogarty International Center and the International Clinical and Operational and Health Services Training Award at Case Western, as well as the Rakai Health Sciences Project and Uganda Cares, as well as Mbarara University and Makerere University, who are our partners in this project. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph, for this communication. Now this paper is open for questions. Do we have question for Joseph? Joseph, did your model include the costs for the drug for the treatment of opportunistic infections?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's included in the cost of illness for stage 3 and 4. So those costs were there.
Two questions. The first one is, I suspect that you did not include the cost of the facility, or the building the facility. If you did that, the facility-based care, would it be equally competitive?
We didn't have those costs. I believe that most of the infrastructure exists, but I think that would probably drive facility-based care to become a little bit less cost-effective.
The other thing is, in your mobile model, would it change the equation if you use different types of mobile? I don't know exactly what the model looked like, but if you use cars or ambulances or trucks or bicycles, I mean, is the means of transportation driving the cost? Is the personnel?
I think the key cost driver would be transportation. And remember, this perspective was the Ministry of Health, and that implies that you forget about what the patient pays. But then if the Ministry of Health pays for transport to people's homes, then that's what causes home-based care to be expensive. And we haven't done the first-time costs for vehicles and for infrastructure, and our working assumption is that those would be already in existence.
Thank you. We have two questions there.
Thank you for that nice presentation. I'm just wondering if you've thought a little bit in following through on Julio's question about the fixed costs that are associated with facilities, that is infrastructure, which is usually quite great, and one would have to actually have ongoing maintenance costs to go into that and factoring that in. And then with the home-based or mobile care, what are the array of levels of proficiency that you need? For instance, in Haiti, they have unskilled outreach workers who do the amount of work, which is relatively inexpensive, versus having physicians go out there, and so it would be the level of skills. And have you looked at various models in the home-based care and factored it into your cost-effectiveness analysis?
Yeah, those are all very, very good questions, and your points are well taken. I would say, though, that first of all, our working assumption, especially from Uganda, is that infrastructure would be present, and really the health centers exist, and that all overhead costs would be taken care of. Now, that is not always the case, but it was our working assumption. With regard to personnel, some data from our group indicate that task shifting has a very, very positive economic impact, and that would be a good addition to the model, and it's a point well taken.
Thank you very much.
Next, could you please identify yourself?
Yeah, next. Sylvia Guillemi from Vancouver, Canada. I wanted to ask you if there was a chance for patients that went in one type of model, for example, in the home-based model, to switch to the facility-level model, by meaning that once they were more stabilized and they were identified by the healthcare system, if you can switch patients from one model to the other. Did you explore that possibility?
I didn't quite get your question, but if I got it correctly, we really assumed that in our cohort, once when you were directed into one model, then you didn't have a chance to switch. But obviously, in real life, it would be imperative that people could switch. And I would like also to emphasize that really, we're not trying to say that home-based care is bad, but we're just contributing to the policy discussion and saying the burden of evidence is on home-based care to demonstrate cost-effectiveness.
Okay, the last one.
Sandy Rutherford from Simon Fraser University. In optimizing delivery of healthcare operations, scheduling theory is used a lot, at least in the West. But that's a lot easier to do with facility-based care versus home-based care. Was that part of your calculation?
No, that wasn't part of our calculation. And that's also a point well taken. But obviously, in a modeling framework, the complexity, there's limitations with how much you can model. But that's a point well taken.
Thank you, Joseph, for this paper. Now we are moving to the next one, the paper 303, the ACTG 5202. Shorter time to virologic failure with abacavir lamivudine than tenofovir FTC as part of the combination therapy in treatment-naive subject with the screening with HIV RNA more than 10,000 copies per ml. Paul, you have the floor.
On behalf of the ACTG 5202 team, I'd like to thank the organizers for allowing us to present these data, ACTG 5202, which compare abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC in patients with screening HIV RNA greater than 100,000 copies. As you know, abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC are recommended NRTIs in multiple guidelines for initial therapy. Our hypothesis related to the NRTIs was that abacavir 3TC was equivalent to tenofovir FTC when combined with efavirenz or atazanavir. This is our study design. 1,858 patients were enrolled and then randomized to one of four treatment strategies. For the nucleoside component, they received tenofovir FTC plus abacavir placebo, or they received abacavir 3TC plus tenofovir placebo. And then the third drug was either efavirenz or ritonavir-boosted atazanavir. The nucleoside component of the study was blinded, and patients were stratified upon entry to have less than or greater than 100,000 copies of HIV RNA. The study began in September of 2005 and completed enrollment in November of 2007. We planned 96 weeks of follow-up after the last subject was enrolled, and the study completion, therefore, is anticipated in the fall of 2009. We have three primary endpoints. The first endpoint is an efficacy endpoint, which is a time to virologic failure endpoint. Early virologic failure was defined as a confirmed HIV RNA greater than 1,000 copies between weeks 16 and 24. Later virologic failure was a confirmed HIV RNA greater than 200 copies from weeks 24 on. This could be either failure to achieve a viral load less than 200 or achieving it and then rebounding. The safety endpoint was timed to the first grade 3 or 4 sign, symptom, or lab abnormality, at least one grade higher than baseline, and tolerability was the time to modification of the initially randomized regimen. In January of 2008, the Data Safety Monitoring Board met to review the study for efficacy for the first time, and they found excess virologic failures with abacavir 3TC. The DSMB requested that the four arms be combined to two, and we do an analysis comparing abacavir 3TC versus tenofovir FTC. The findings of this analysis showed highly significant differences between abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC, with excess virologic failures on the abacavir 3TC arm occurring in the greater than 100,000 copy stratum. They then recommended that we unblind this stratum, and that is the results you'll be hearing today. Only the results from this stratum and only the comparison between abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC. This included 797 study subjects with a median follow-up of 60 weeks. There was a low rate of study dropout or loss to study, and it did not differ between arms. The baseline characteristics of the study are shown here. Overall, the study subjects were well matched. They averaged 39 years of age. 85% were men. The baseline HIV RNA was 5.1 log, and the baseline CD4 cell count was 181 cells. Genotype was required at screening only if patients had recently acquired HIV infection within the past 12 months. However, it was done at some study sites as standard of care at the time. So overall, 43% of study subjects did have genotype testing done at baseline before they entered the study. If patients had resistance mutations as defined by the IAS USA list, then they were excluded from the study. And here is the primary endpoint, which is time to virologic failure. As you can see, there were 57 events in the abacavir arm and 26 events in the tenofovir FTC arm, and this was highly statistically significant with a p-value of 0.0003 and a hazard ratio for failure of 2.33. I just want to orient you. Red is the abacavir, blue is the tenofovir, and along the horizontal axis are time in weeks, and along the vertical axis is the proportion remaining free of virologic failure. This slide looks at the timing and type of virologic failure that occurred in this study. Once again, there were 57 virologic failures in the abacavir 3TC arm and 26 in the tenofovir FTC arm. And you can see that there's a consistent excess of failures in the abacavir 3TC arm, regardless of the criterion we use for virologic failure, either early failure as shown here, or later failure without achieving less than 200, or later failure after achieving 200. We did conduct a post hoc analysis looking at patients who achieved viral loads below 50 copies at least twice. In this analysis, virologic rebound was infrequent in both arms and did not differ significantly between tenofovir FTC and abacavir 3TC. This next analysis looks at the time to regimen completion, which would be the first occurrence of either virologic failure or nucleoside modification. There were 114 such events for abacavir 3TC and 68 events in tenofovir FTC for a p-value of less than 0.0001. Nucleoside modifications occurred in 95 abacavir 3TC patients and 52 tenofovir FTC patients. In 5202, we allowed patients who experienced virologic failure or nucleoside modification to remain in the study. And we were able, therefore, to look at outcomes not just of our first regimens, but also of subsequent regimens. In this analysis, we look at the proportion of patients who are below 50 copies at various time points, allowing for regimen changes and prior virologic failure. At week 48, 75% of the abacavir 3TC arm and 80% of the tenofovir FTC arm had viral loads less than 50 copies for a p-value of 0.20. This describes the CD4 cell count change, and as you can see, there's no difference between study arms. Study subjects started with a mean CD4 cell count of in the high 100s, and at the end of this observation period, were over 400 in both arms. We wish to explore the possible relationship between suspected drug hypersensitivity reactions and virologic failure, and that analysis is shown here. There were 27 patients in both study arms who had suspected drug hypersensitivity. It's important to emphasize that screening HLA B5701 testing was only done on a small fraction of the patients in this study, and generally not towards the end of the study after the presentation of the PREDICT data. As you can see, however, the proportion of patients who experienced suspected drug hypersensitivity and then went on to have virologic failure was relatively small and did not differ between the two study arms. Now moving on to safety. The time to the first safety event, which is safety is remember defined as grade 3 or 4 sign or symptom, or a lab abnormality 1 grade higher than baseline. There were 130 events for abacavir 3TC and 78 events for tenofovir FTC for a p-value of less than 0.0001. The hazard ratio is 1.89. When we look at these safety events, as shown in the next table, I want to emphasize a few things. These are some of the events that occurred in more than 5% of the patient population. A lot of this is comprised of metabolic effects meaning changes in lipids. And these changes in lipids that occurred between the two arms were generally small in magnitude and I think unlikely to be clinically significant. In addition, there are quite a few nonspecific aches and pains and other things that accounted for this difference. There were certain targeted events that we are interested in that were protocol defined and reported by the study sites. These included fractures, myocardial infarction, malignancy, renal failure, suspected HSR, and deaths. And as you can see, there were low numbers of these events in both arms, notably no myocardial infarctions in either arm, and two cases of renal failure in both arms. There was one subject in the abacavir 3TC arm who died possibly due to drug hypersensitivity reaction after rechallenge. So to conclude, in patients with screening HIV RNA greater than 100,000 copies per ml, abacavir 3TC was associated with a significantly shorter time to virologic failure than tenofovir FTC. There was no obvious relationship between suspected HSR and virologic failure. In addition, abacavir 3TC had a shorter time to the first adverse event. The resistance analysis, including baseline and with failure, as well as numerous other analyses related to this population, are currently ongoing. And I want to say also that the remainder of ACTG 5202 continues until November 2009. And this includes the blinded nucleosides in the lower viral load stratum, as well as efavirenz versus atazanavir. My last slide really discusses why the results of 5202 might differ from other studies. It goes without saying that study follow-up, design, endpoints, and conduct clearly differ between studies, and we'll hear more about that shortly. But if you look only at the studies that directly compare abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC, that's 5202 and HEAT, two things stand out. One is that the sample size in 5202 is substantially larger, and this larger sample size may have allowed us to describe differences between the groups with greater precision than with a smaller sample size. And the second is that our study used a different third drug, either atazanavir, ritonavir, or efavirenz, versus lopinavir, ritonavir capsules in HEAT. I'll also say that there are other studies, of course, looking at abacavir 3TC in various prospective trials, but they did not compare the similar nucleoside strategies. I'd like to finish by thanking my protocol co-chair, Eric Darr, my vice chairs, Ann Collier and Margaret Fischel, and our chief statistician, Kamlin Tierney. There is also a large group of protocol members who are listed here, and thanks also to our industry collaborators from Abbott, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Gilead Sciences, and GlaxoSmithKline, and thanks especially to the numerous ACVG sites and the patients who volunteered to be in this study. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul, for this communication. Now this paper is open for questions. Yes, microphone number one.
Paul, can you tell us how many people stopped therapy because of virologic failure? Because at the end of your discussion, the numbers less than 50 are similar.
So patients experienced virologic failure, they were allowed to either remain on their original nucleosides or modify their nucleosides depending on the results of resistance testing. So
do you know how many?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but once virologic failure occurred, management of those patients was according to sort of standard of care at the site and could include, for example, if patients had no resistance at all, continuing the same regimen with redoubled interest and adherence.
Microphone two.
If you consider...
Could you please identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry. Annemarie Wensing, University Utrecht in the Netherlands. If you consider that transmitted resistance is about 10%, and mainly that will be timed in analog mutations, can you think that this could be the reason that people started with abacavir did less well, because abacavir regimens might be more affected by that?
So the question is about transmitted resistance. So as I mentioned, 43% of the study subjects did have genotypes, and they were excluded if they had resistance. And since we don't have resistance data on the other group yet, we did do a sensitivity analysis looking at whether a patient had a genotype or didn't have a genotype, changed the outcome in any way, and based on that analysis, it did not. So.
Microphone number one.
Bolin, Los Angeles. I noticed that the abacavir arm had significantly greater adverse events, and I wondered, did you do any other measures of adherence? So is it possible that the people that had greater adverse events in the abacavir arm just didn't take their meds, and this could be responsible?
So the question about adherence, whether it influences outcome, it is possible, and one of the analyses that we plan to do is reported adherence.
Microphone number two.
José Gatel from Barcelona, Spain. No, the question is related of whether the difference can be explained for those patients who didn't reach undetectable viral load before week 24. Because in the stratum of patients with more than 100,000 copies, not all antiretroviral regimes may be equally fast to reach undetectable values, and then later on they can achieve at the same rate. And this is what we have seen, for example, in the Integrase studies.
Well, when we all of the protocol chairs have to sign off on the virologic failures, and I can tell you, just looking at those, only a very small proportion, if any, if I can remember, would have met that reason for virologic failure as you described, meaning people who are still on their way down and still are called virologic failure. But that's a specific question that we'll look into further.
Thank you.
The last question.
I'm Dr. Marshall D'Souza from Fort Myers, Florida, United States. I'm surprised that in both the arms, the hypersensitivity reaction was similar. My first question is, what kind of criteria was used? And the second question is, what was the third regimen? Was it the efavirenz or was it the ATV and the ritonavir?
So sites were extensively educated about recognition and management of suspected hypersensitivity before the study began, because obviously in a blinded study we want people to be very cautious about this issue. What we noted in this study, which has been seen in previous studies, especially studies that include efavirenz, is that the rate of miscalls or overcalls on HSR is significantly high. So it has not been uncommon in other studies to have similar rates of HSR in blinded studies. The second question was related to the third study drug, and the DSMB has not released to us the data involving the third drug, either for toxicity or for efficacy.
Thank you, Paul. Now it's my pleasure to give the floor to my co-chair, Julio.
Thank you very much. The next paper is going to be presented by Keith Papa, and it's entitled Abacavir Lamivudin Shows Robust Virologic Responses in ART-Naive Patients for Baseline Viral Loads of Over 100,000 and Less Than 100,000 by Endpoint Use in ACTG 5202 by Papa, Hernandez, Ha, Schaffer, Brothers, and Lyon.
I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to present on behalf of my co-authors, Hernandez, Ha, Schaffer, Brothers, and Lyon. EPTICOM virologic response data in ART-naive patients with baseline viral loads above and below 100,000 copies using the ACTG 5202 endpoint. The A5202 study compares an EPTICOM and Truvada backbone with either efavirenz or boosted atazanavir. As just presented by Dr. Sachs, the A5202 endpoints are unique. The interim results are unexpected in that we have not seen data suggesting EPTICOM is less potent in patients with high viral load. The data is not consistent with prior clinical experience and raise the question of whether the two nucleoside backbones have comparable efficacy and safety. Because of these points, when GSK became aware of these data from 5202, we undertook an evaluation of data from six recent trials using the 5202 endpoints. And now we include 96-week data from HEAT, a fully powered, double-blind, randomized trial comparing EPTICOM with Truvada with lopinavir-ritonavir. In my presentation, I will address the question of whether abacavir 3TC is really less effective in patients with viral loads greater than or equal to 100,000 copies. I will review data from six trials utilizing the 5202 endpoint, and I will review the 96-week HEAT data. I will also address whether abacavir 3TC is really less tolerable than tenofovir 3TC, utilizing HEAT data, including the A5202 safety endpoint, adverse experiences leading to discontinuations, and lipid changes utilizing the NSEP guidelines. As you've heard, the primary efficacy endpoint in 5T02 was time to virologic failure using Kaplan-Meier methodology. This was defined as confirmed viral load greater than or equal to 1,000 copies at or after week 16 and before 24 weeks, or greater than or equal to 200 copies at or after 24 weeks. The 1,000 copy cutoff and the use of week 16 criteria is what is unique in this study. Epsicom is a well-studied compound with a variety of third agents. We analyzed six recent clinical studies which utilized an abacavir 3TC backbone with a non-nucleoside and with boosted PIs. The studies highlighted in yellow utilized similar regimens to that used in 5202. These trials were conducted under good clinical practice standards. They were monitored, audited, and some included as registrational trials so that they are at the highest standard of conduct. This slide presents the Kaplan-Meier estimate of probability of virologic survival by week 48 by baseline using the A5202 endpoint for five of the trials just described. Along the y-axis is percent of virologic survival, and across the x-axis are the titles of the respected trials along with their sample size. The red bar is low viral load stratum. The green bar is greater than or equal to 100,000 copies. You can see that there are no appreciable differences between the low and high viral load data. In a total of 2,940 treatment-naive patients, the range of response in all six studies is between 87 and 95%. As in the previous slide, this is the same endpoint, probability of protocol-defined virologic survival by week 48 by viral load using the A5202 efficacy endpoint. The orange bar represents the Epsicom treatment and the blue bar's Truvada. Again, this is from the HEAT study. The left bars are the low viral load stratum, and the right bars are the greater than or equal to 100,000 copies. As was the case for the five clinical studies on the prior slide, the outcomes in the HEAT study are also very similar for the low and high viral load patients. This slide presents primary and secondary efficacy endpoint data for the fully powered HEAT study. The 95% confidence intervals are shown across the top. This portrays the RNA less than 50 copies at week 96. For more details, Dr. Kim Smith has late breaker poster 1138, and it is being presented now in Hall D level 2. As reviewed, the missing equal fail data at week 48 was 68 and 67% as presented at the retrovirus conference. These data form the basis for a conclusion of non-inferiority between Epsicom and Truvada in the HEAT trial, and the result is consistent across the various endpoints. Regarding efficacy, summary data from six recent trials using the AE5202 endpoints indicates consistency in efficacy between low and high viral load data. The HEAT 96-week data confirmed non-inferiority of abacavir 3TC with tenofovir FTC. The primary safety endpoint in 5202 was defined as time to development of first grade 3 or 4 sign, symptom, or lab abnormality that is at least one grade higher than at baseline. CK and bilirubin values were excluded, and as Dr. Sachs indicated, HLA-B5701 testing was not the standard of care at study initiation, so it was not part of this study. We saw similar results for the safety endpoint in the five clinical studies just reviewed. Since the HEAT trial compares EpsiCom with the Truvada backbone directly, we present the results for the 5202 endpoint in the HEAT study on this slide. These are the specific events that are grade 3 or 4 sign, symptom, or lab abnormality greater than or equal to one grade higher than baseline for patients with baseline viral loads greater than or equal to 100,000 copies per ml. You can see the frequency of events is low and comparable between treatment groups. The true test of regimen tolerability is measuring study discontinuation. Here are the specific events in two or more subjects with baseline viral loads greater than or equal to 100,000 copies from the HEAT trial at week 96. From the table, you can see the events occurred very infrequently and were comparable between treatment arms. This slide presents fasting lipid changes from baseline to week 96 for subjects with baseline viral loads greater than or equal to 100,000 copies using the NSEP cutoffs in the HEAT trial. The pink bars indicate the NSEP cutoffs. Notable are similar increases in triglyceride for both EpsiCom and Truvada at week 96, and increases in beneficial HDL cholesterol for both EpsiCom and Truvada. Not shown on this slide is data indicating a favorable total cholesterol to HDL ratio at week 96 for both EpsiCom and Truvada arms. Regarding safety data, the HEAT data utilizing the 5202 endpoints as well as typical safety endpoints indicate both abacavir 3TC and tenofovir FTC regimens are well tolerated, have comparable safety, as well as few study discontinuations due to adverse experiences. The recent 5202 findings are unexpected. They differ from clinical experience, and they utilize primary efficacy and safety endpoints, which are unique. Utilizing the 5202 endpoints, analysis of six recent clinical studies using abacavir 3TC demonstrate robust results, irrespective of baseline viral loads. And according to the data just reviewed, EpsiCom is effective in patients with high viral loads. The 96-week data confirm non-inferiority of EpsiCom with Truvada. Both regimens are well tolerated, comparable safety, and few study discontinuations leading to few AEs leading to study discontinuations. I would also like to mention late breaker information as is presented in Dr. Smith's poster. There was no increase in CRP and IL-6 from baseline to weeks 48 and 96 with abacavir 3TC or tenofovir FTC in the HEAT trial. There were no significant differences between the treatment groups, and I refer you to her poster for further information. We, as part of the 5202 study team, look forward to further data regarding the impact of baseline resistance, treatment interruptions, adherence data, lipid changes using the NSEP guidelines, stratifying by screening viral load using local labs, as well as differences in endpoints. I would like to acknowledge and especially thank all participating study subjects, site personnel, and study teams. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Identify yourself, please.
Gulick from New York. Keith, thanks for that presentation. One of the ways that we evaluate clinical trials when we try to apply them to clinical care is how generalizable the results are to the patients that we take care of. We heard from Paul Sachs that 5202 had representation from 15% women, and over half of the participants were people of color, either African American or Latino. Could you give us a sense of the gender and race ethnic breakdown of the studies that you just reviewed for us?
I don't have the specific numbers, Tripp. That's a great question. I would say that they do provide broad representation. I can't tell you that they're exactly the same numbers as in 5202.
Can we take a question for the other microphone?
Emmanuel Vlahakis from Sydney. Is it possible that ACTG 5202 being so much larger was able to pick up a smaller difference which would have fallen outside your non-inferiority assumptions in HEAT but would still be a clinically relevant difference for prescribing clinicians?
Can you restate that again, please?
Well, the ACTG study is much larger than HEAT, so it would be able to pick up smaller differences which may be falling outside the statistical assumptions for the HEAT study. These differences may not be seen in HEAT, but seen in ACTG 5202 and be relevant for prescribing clinicians.
My understanding of the power is that it allows one to perform an analysis with greater precision, not necessarily to pick up larger differences. The HEAT study is fully powered at 90% power for non-inferiority, and that is what it showed. Epsicom is non-inferior to Truvada.
I'm going to take two more questions, one from Joe and another one from the other microphone.
Yeah, hi. Joe Iron from Chapel Hill. One, I'd just like to state that the whether one study is more real than the other, I think, is a matter of debate. And I think the way you introduced the your presentation that you were going to show what was really true was a little bit, disingenuous. So my question for you is, it looked like in each of the six studies that you showed that the success at a lower viral load was actually greater than at a higher viral load. So if you actually did a cumulative analysis across all six studies, would you see a significant difference between abacavir 3TC at a lower viral load versus a higher viral load?
That's a great question. Thanks, Joe. I think it's important, certainly, to note that cross-study comparisons are difficult. These trials were different as far as entry criteria and so forth. I think that really what we have is to look at the consistency of response and the percentage point difference. I would state as being not clinically meaningful. I think also if you compare to recent data that has been presented with other recent agents, such as in Artemis and in Castle, you will also note a fairly significant drop-off, or at least a difference between patients in low viral load and high viral load with a different backbone than Epsicom.
One very brief question, and that's it.
Well, I'm Abdul Babika from London. I was going to ask two questions, but I'll just start with the first one. You have shown us graphs by 48 weeks and by 96 weeks, which shows comparable efficacy in terms of virological survival. Now, although virological survival was estimated by Kaplan-Meier using the same endpoint at the ACTG 5202, the comparison just at fixed weeks, 48 or 96 weeks, is not the same at the primary analysis in the ACTG 5202. In particular, if there is a higher failure rate early on, but then patients catch up in that back of A3TC, you would not see the differences which were shown in the ACTG study. So have you done any analysis by just looking at the hazard ratio across follow-up in all these studies?
No, I don't believe we have, but I guess I would make the point again that we included data from all these studies from the very earliest time point onward. I guess, the main point, and and I take Joe Iran's point certainly seriously. I'm not raising that, 5202 is anything but unique. I'm not indicating that it, doesn't have solid data and very good data. But if you do look at those earlier time points, what I can say is that the failure rate is higher than what it is in these six recent clinical trials. So, again, that's the point that I'm trying to make.
We're going to move on to the next paper. Thank you very much. The next paper is entitled Use of Nucleoside Reverse Transcriptase Inhibitors and Risk of Myocardial Infarction in HIV-Infected Patients Enrolled in the SMART Study, and it's been presented by Jens Lundgren on behalf of the SMART Insight and DAD study groups. Jens.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege and an honor on behalf of the SMART Insight and DAD study group to share this data with you. The background for these analyses is that we reported in Lancet in April of this year that abacavir was associated with excess risk of myocardial infarction. The signal was characterized and was present for current use, but not for cumulative or past use, suggesting that abacavir may increase the chance that existing atherosclerosis converts to cardiovascular disease. This finding was robust after adjustment for cardiovascular risk factors, suggesting that channeling bias for known cardiovascular risk factors is less likely as an explanation for the findings. The aims of the present analysis was to establish whether this finding can be reproduced in another data set where the utilization of various nucleosides and nucleotides, abbreviated NRTIs, differed from that in DAD, and furthermore to explore plausible biological mechanism for the effects. SMART was a randomized trial that compared two strategies of using antiretroviral treatment. For the present analysis, for the clinical outcome data, we focused on all patients that were randomized to the VS arm and the viral suppression arm. I'm going to show you biomarker levels of six markers of inflammation and coagulation at study entry among patients who already, when they entered into SMART, were on NRTIs. And that will be for 791 patients. Now, for clarity, use of NRTIs in this presentation, we divided patients into three mutually exclusive groups. Those on abacavir, not receiving didanosine, entitled the ABC non-DDI group. The second group was patients receiving didanosine with or without abacavir and other nucleosides, entitled the DDI group. And then finally, NRTIs other than ABC and the DDI was entitled others. This graph shows you the entire population of patients that were on nucleosides when they entered into SMART. I could have shown you similar results for the 2,752 patients that was randomized in the VS arm that constitute the population of patients from the clinical outcome data, as well as the 791 patients that was included in the biomarker findings. The results would be the same. I have only time to show one of these tables. You will see that at entry, the age of the patient was 44 years, 27% were female, suppression rate was 83%. Remind you, everybody is on treatment. CD4 cells count as 630, 4% had a history of cardiovascular disease, 39% were current smokers. We did in a subset of patients baseline ECG, and among those with an ECG available at study entry, 36% had evidence of ischemic abnormalities. 7% had a history of diabetes. Furthermore, in the same population of patients, 19% was using blood pressure lowering drugs, 18% lipid lowering drugs. The total to HDL cholesterol is 4.6. Mind you that a normal ratio should be 4.5 or below. 31% were either in the past or currently using abacavir. Of course, 100% in the abacavir group, 28% in the DDI group, and 7% in the other group had previously used abacavir. 39% of the abacavir patients were taking it with NRTIs exclusively, and that percentage was much lower in the two other arms. 21% were using tenofovir. 15% of this cohort had five or more cardiovascular risk factors at entry. I'm going to describe four outcomes. These outcomes are all pre-specified either in the publication in the journal from 2006 or in a follow-up in publication by Andrew Phillips in Antibiotic Therapy earlier this year. Of note, all events are adjudicated by the Endpoint Review Committee. We operate with cardiovascular major events, which will be clinical or silent MI, stroke, surgery for coronary artery disease, and cardiovascular death. We, for the example, since myocardial infarct clinical MIs were the primary endpoint in DAD, we also singled that particular endpoint out. We did also an expanded version of the major endpoints, which in addition to those I mentioned above, also included the peripheral vascular disease, congestive heart failure, drug treatment for coronary artery disease, and unwitnessed death. Finally, we operate with a third major outcome entitled minor cardiovascular disease, which is congestive heart failure, peripheral vascular disease, or coronary artery disease requiring drug treatments. This is the main analysis of the findings. On this slide, we are comparing the hazard ratio of experience either of the four events shown on the left side of the slide in patients that was either currently receiving abacavir or other NRTIs. You will appreciate that the number of endpoints differs. In particular, we only had 19 patients with an MI. The highest number of endpoints that we have is in the expanded definition of the major cardiovascular disease endpoints. If we focus on this point in particular, the hazard ratio was 1.9, which was exactly the same as was found in DAD, and you will also appreciate for all four of the endpoints, it is in similar directions, suggesting an association between current use of abacavir and excess risk of these outcomes. I've taken, I should mention that these analyses are presented either unadjusted or after adjustment for cardiovascular risk factors. If we focus on the adjusted values for abacavir and then also present the data for patients who were receiving DDI with and without abacavir, you will appreciate that the confidence interval for patients that belongs to this group for these outcomes are much wider than for abacavir, given the smaller number of patients, and also that for all four of the outcomes, the confidence interval overlap one, and for three of them, the hazard ratio was exactly one. Of note, for the primary endpoint in DAD, namely myocardial infarction, we see the same trend as we saw in DAD, although the power to detect such a signal here is, of course, much more limited. I need the next slide. Thank you. Somebody's playing with my slides.
Go back.
I want to go for somebody's. They're going. I need the next slide. Next slide. Next slide. And the next slide. Thank you. This slide gives you the hazard ratios for using abacavir versus using other NRTIs according to cardiovascular risk status at study entry. At study entry, we stratified the patients into those who had five or more cardiovascular risk factors or those who had less so. Also, for the subgroup of patients where we have baseline ECG, we stratified patients into whether they had baseline ischemic abnormalities or no. We then compared whether the excess risk of the expanded definition of major cardiovascular disease endpoints was seen more frequently in patients that fulfilled this criteria as opposed to those who did not. There is an apparent further excess risk in those who fulfilled this endpoint, although you should note that the appropriate statistical way of testing for differences between those two is an interaction analysis, and the p-value was 0.1, i.e. not significant. The p-value was even further remotely significant focusing on this. In addition, we explored, based on baseline biomarker levels, whether there was any difference in biomarker levels at study entry among patients who already, when they came into the study, was a nucleoside NRTIs, depending on whether that was an ABC, DDI, or other. In the for So you can compare the levels that is shown for Abacavir and DDI. We have shown the median levels in the other group below the slide. You will appreciate that after adjustment for cardiovascular risk factors and other factors, we saw a 27% higher level of high sensitivity CRP and a 16% higher level of IL-6 in patients that were on Abacavir study entry as opposed to those in others. Such levels, such differences in biomarker levels were not observed in patients that were on DDI. There is a variety of limitations in these analyses. These are essentially observational analyses leading to the possibility of channeling bias, i.e. that patients at an a priori excess underlying risk of cardiovascular disease may have been preferentially placed on Abacavir. Of note, and shown on previous slides, cardiovascular risk factor profile was fairly compatible between groups. And furthermore, and more importantly, adjustment for known and quantifiable cardiovascular risk factors failed to affect the association. Of course, the definitive solution to this question is to perform a randomized controlled trial, which would require at least 15,000 patients and last for 2 to 3 years. Another limitation is that there is a possibility that patients on Abacavir had elevated high sensitivity CRP and IL-6 levels for reasons other than use of Abacavir. The way to probably resolve this is to perform prospective follow-up studies looking at percent changes for individual patients. Again, preferentially in a randomized controlled trial setting. For some of the endpoints, we have limited power. And then finally, in terms of overlap of patient populations between those in DND and SMART, some of the sites do participate in both trials, but when we focused on sites that do not participate in DAD, they contributed with more than 90% of the endpoints shown, and in that group of patients, the findings that I've shown you are entirely consistent with those that are presented here. So in summary, consistent with DAD, current use of Abacavir during follow-up in SMART was associated with an excess risk of cardiovascular disease. And furthermore, Abacavir use at study entry is associated with increased levels of IL-6 and high sensitivity CRP. Our proposed mechanism of action for how Abacavir may increase cardiovascular risk is that the drug causes an increased propensity for subclinical already existing atherosclerosis to cause cardiovascular disease. The data are not consistent with Abacavir affecting the atherosclerotic process per se. The increased propensity may be caused by pro-inflammatory properties of the drug, and IL-6 and high-sensitivity CRP may be surrogates of ongoing inflammatory reactions in the coronary arterial wall, leading to instability of existing plaques. So in conclusion, Abacavir is associated with excess cardiovascular risk in two observational studies. The drug does not appear to affect the underlying atherosclerotic process per se, but may cause coronary arteritis, leading to instability of plaques. This adverse effect appears to be only clinically relevant to consider among patients with elevated underlying cardiovascular risk. I should note that a manuscript is in press as Fast Track in AIDS with an aimed publication date of the 2nd of September of this year. I would want to make note and acknowledge my co-authors, in particular Jim Needham, Jack Newhouse, and Birgit Grund from the Statistical Center at the University of Minnesota, where these analysis was performed, as well as to the two study groups, as well as to NIAID, NIH, that supported SMART. Thank you for your attention.
Jens, thank you for the very eloquent presentation. Could you comment on the high number of people that were on nucleosides alone in the study? And could you speculate on the HLA-Abacavir connection?
Sure. Thanks. No, that's a very good question. So we of course thought whether this is essentially another manifestation of hypersensitivity reaction, i.e. just another phenotype of having HLA-B5701. Of course, that phenotype, the hypersensitivity reaction, will present itself within the first 3 months of starting the drug to begin with. But the effect that we are seeing here is in patients who have been on the drug for several years, So it is very unlikely that genotype is, that it is in that subgroup of patients where this problem exists.
Well, however, as you know, only a fraction of the people who have the genotype go on to have the reaction. So the possibility still exists that you could clean this out by using HLA.
Absolutely, and the way to, I think this is a very important point, and I would encourage people who is, have access to genotypic material to explore this question further. It may be that haplotype, it may be other HLA haplotypes that leads to a potentially ongoing, maybe subclinical inflammatory reaction in some patients.
And with regards to the high number of people on nucleoside alone, that's out of normal sort of practice.
Well, I mean, it's essentially reflecting use of Trisivir, and we did ask, we did address in our analysis whether adjustment for that factor would be explaining the excess risk, and there was similar excess risk irrespective of whether Abacavir was used together with other nucleosides or as background therapy.
First question.
Kimberly Smith, Western Chicago. I actually wanted to follow up on Julio's question regarding the triple. They were on triple nuke alone. Have you done an analysis excluding those individuals, considering that we know that protease inhibitors by themselves have an impact on immune activation?
We obviously, in SMART, struggling with numbers, as you will appreciate. We did, however, look at that, as I just explained to Julio, and didn't find that to affect the risk. Furthermore, we also explored that in the DAD study, and the data that we had in SMART and those in DAD are entirely consistent.
Joel Gallant from Baltimore. Now, your abstract says that when you compared abacavir specifically with tenofovir as opposed to other nucleosides, you had similar findings, but you didn't mention that in your presentation. Can you comment on that?
I had a lot of data to present in 10 minutes. One of the sensitivity analyses that we did, as you were referring to, was that in the other NRTI group, we did take patients out in an exploratory analysis that did not use tenofovir. And found essentially the same findings as what I was presenting on the slides. Clearly, that type of analysis is limited by the fact that we're reducing our reference group, and we really have to await further analysis of the DAD study group data set, which have many more events where we can finally nail that question.
Given the interest of the data, I'm going to take the last four questions, but no more, quickly.
Peter Ingmar, San Francisco. Any incidence of stroke, and if so, why not?
I didn't hear that.
Any incidence of a stroke, and if not, why not?
There is a few strokes that is encompassed in the definition of major cardiovascular disease, but stroke is traditionally seen in HIV patients as well as in general population, much more frequently in older patients above 60. So that's the explanation why I think we don't see as many strokes currently in HIV patients.
Halbrick, San Diego. Nice job, Jens.
Thank you.
You mentioned there's about 10% overlap in the two cohorts. Did you do an analysis that excluded the overlapping patients, and did you find the same results when those patients who were overlapped were excluded?
So let me just say, I didn't say 10% overlap. I said that if we restricted our analysis to sites that for sure did not participate in DAD, 90% of the outcomes, 90% of the events were seen in sites that did not participate in DAD, and that clearly these are the sites and the events that drive this analysis. we can furthermore say that in those sites that participated in both studies, it is rather limited how many patients actually participated in both. If you want to ask me to quantify exactly how many patients it is among those sites, I can't do that because the two studies are operating with anonymous data, and therefore we can't cross-link them. But clearly that's not explaining our findings, as I was trying to underline.
One final question.
I'm Dr. Marshall D'Souza from Fort Myers, Florida, USA. I have a large number of patients both on EpsiCom-based and Truvada-based regimens. And in the EpsiCom-based regimen, both in the HLA B27O1 pre and post, my patient seems to be doing clinically, virologically, and metabolically well. So my question is, why is this divergence between the clinical trial data and the clinical data. Is there any explanation? I noted the IL-6 association and HSCRP association. Is there any other explanation?
First of all, I would like to remind you that DAD is not a clinical trial, but that's actually a cohort of patients that reflect the usage of the drug. Furthermore, I want to just emphasize that the finding that we have been describing here in SMART, as well as we described previously in DAD, and the problem in terms of clinical relevance are really only seen in a very small group of your patient cohort, namely those who have several underlying cardiovascular risk factors. And at least in the DAD cohort, a few patients have that conglomerate of cardiovascular risk factors. So I think for most patients, this is not really an issue, but for the older patients, those who have multiple cardiovascular risk factors, that's where I think we will have, this is the subgroup of patients where this may become a problem.
Thank you, Jens. Thank you for a very nice presentation, and thank you, Papa Salih, for your help. Thank you all. The session is closed.